Welcome to the Tongcast. I'm your host, Jesse Merz. As you know, the Tongcast is the most important talk show on the planet, where each week we discuss all things theater with the great artists of our day. I'm coming to you live from Detroit, Michigan at Wayne State University. Today's guest is a noted performer, director, writer, and author. His work is arresting, thrilling, hilarious, dark, and bitter. He's one of my favorites, and I know he's one of yours. Today I bring to you Mr. Paul Thomas Anderson.
Hi, it's Todd Anderson, not Paul Thomas. Paul Thomas Anderson's wonderful. I enjoyed your description of him, but I'm Todd. I'm Todd Anderson.
I'm sorry. you're Paul Thomas. You're the director, right?
No. My name's Todd Anderson. I had nothing to do with Magnolia or Boogie Nights or any of those. I've seen those movies. I'm an actor from Hollywood. Yeah.
Oh, you're the guy from Weeds.
Well, yeah, I was on Weeds. Yeah, I did a few episodes of Weeds. Yeah, a couple years ago.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I can adjust some of these questions for you. I see here that you went to you studied theater. Okay, so you hopefully we can talk a little bit about theater and the connections between theater and filmmaking.
I apologize for the cross signals. I don't know why my people would have said that that I was Paul Thomas Anderson. It seems.
Yeah, I don't want to pretend like I'm not disappointed.
Well, don't. I mean, I would be disappointed too if I was expecting, you know, Paul Thomas Anderson, and then Todd Anderson showed up.
Okay, so Todd Anderson, Todd Robert Anderson. Let me ask you my first question. What is your earliest theatrical memory?
Memory of doing a theater, you mean, on an actual stage, or seeing?
The first thing you ever saw that really spoke to you, and then maybe the follow-up could be your first memory as an actor in the theater.
Oh, golly. I think the first thing I saw in an actual theater, I saw a lot of stuff. I think the first thing that actually moved me was I was in high school, and I saw Kathleen Turner in Boston, in Cat on a Hot Tin Roof.
Mm.
I mean, I'd seen, you know, theater in my small town before and people doing stuff on stage, but I don't think anything blew me away. I mean, and I think she was very good in the play, but I think also, you know, I had a huge crush on Kathleen Turner, and I was like in the second row, and she's very leggy. And that's a good vantage point for a leggy Kathleen Turner to be, you know, a little bit lower, and she's up high on the stage, and it was very exciting. So I don't know if she was actually that good, but I certainly felt like she was, and I was moved by her legginess and performance.
How old were you when you were so moved by Kathleen Turner?
I must have been, you know, I was probably 17 at that point. Yeah. I mean, before that, I think the only, you know, stuff... my parents never took me to the theater when I was a kid. I didn't see any of the any musicals or anything like that. So it was just, yeah, I saw people perform on stage in my small town, but I think that was my first, you know, legit play out at a real theater with real actors. It was very exciting.
Your parents' unwillingness to consistently bring you to a wide variety of theatrical events probably has something to do with why you live in Los Angeles.
Yeah, that's an astute observation. That's a very good observation. Yeah, they didn't. They weren't entertainment. They weren't into entertainment. They were readers. They liked books. I had to go to the, if I wanted to go to the movies, I had to do it myself. My parents did not take me to the movies, save for, you know, Star Wars and Raiders of the Lost Ark. That was about it. Not a lot of going to the movies with them.
How about your first significant theatrical experience as an actor on the theatrical stage?
Well, that was
artist of drama.
That was way before I was actually moved by somebody else's work on the stage. I was in junior high, and I had a teacher who urged me to do the junior high play, which was called "The Butler Did It," a marvelous farcical program. That is a real play, and I played a buffoon detective, Chandler Marlowe, I believe was the character's name, and it was, you know, we just did it for, you know, we did all these rehearsals, and I think we just did it for one night, but, you know, all my friends came, and they laughed, and that was the first time I realized, there is something that I can actually do, because I was lousy at sports, so... It was nice. It was a nice experience.
And playing a buffoon seems to have influenced the rest of your acting career.
Well, I don't think it's that I played a buffoon that influenced the acting career. I think it's that I look like a buffoon, and therefore, and you kind of have to play types. I mean, I have curly red hair and fair skin, and that is reminiscent of a clown. So people expect me to be funny. I don't even think I'm that funny. I think I have to play to that because people expect me to be, because I look kind of like a clown.
So are you actually a brooding, dark, intense artist who's just dying to come out? Instead, your face betrays your actual artistic integrity?
Yeah. I'd rather play like... Mel Gibson-y roles like Lethal Weapon than Tom Hanks-y roles, but I look, you know, Tom Hanks-y, so I get, you know, the dad roles and the guy next door and the friendly guy, which is fine. I mean, it's an acting challenge when really you want to, you know, play crazy and cry and all that stuff. I guess, yeah, you know, I think about this a lot because I do a lot of commercials, and commercials, so much of it is, you know, even if you're playing a sarcastic character, you have to you have to be happy on some on some level. So whenever I see actors, you know, who get Oscars for crying and being crazy, I'm like, that's easy. Acting happy, that's hard. Think of all the actors who struggle with happiness. Have you ever seen Cole Hauser in a movie when he has to be happy? It looks like it hurts him. It looks like it hurts him. But it doesn't look like it hurts me. And I am just as hurt by happiness as Cole Hauser. But, you know, I'm better at playing happy, I guess.
Well, maybe it is time for us to recast you in Los Angeles and to give you that opportunity for that breakout serious role. And I think... You know, just jumping ahead now, where do you dream for your next theatrical adventure to happen? And do you think maybe it's time for you to take on Eugene O'Neill in a Los Angeles theater?
That sounds, well, the truth about Los Angeles theater and taking on things like that is very few people go to the theater in Los Angeles. Unless there are movie stars in the production and it's got a huge budget. As far as the theaters I have access to, that sounds like a lot of work for audiences of 3 and 4 people. although I have in the past, I mean, when I was, you know, younger and I was doing theater all the time. The other thing is I have a 6-year-old kid. So the idea of doing theater at this stage, probably when he's a teenager, I'll get back into it more. But doing theater now will take me away from him all the time. You know, I'll be rehearsing every night as opposed to hanging out with my son. So that's sort of a tricky thing.
Does your son want to work in the theater? Because perhaps the two of you could collaborate in some sort of father-son role. Like maybe there's some Tennessee Williams part we can think of. Maybe he can be your Tom Wingfield and you can be the father who's gone and you could just be the painting on the wall.
I like that. Although, you know what would be kind of fun is do a two, like father-son production of Death of a Salesman. And but the twist is he at 6 will play Willie Loman and I'll just play all the other characters around him. I think that would.
I'm feeling this. In fact, I think it's ready for us to put this up. In fact, maybe Brad Pitt will help us produce it because of what was that movie he did where he got to play a young, tiny, old guy.
Oh, the Button Show, the Benjamin Button program, The Adventures of Tintin's Buttons. I can't remember the name of it.
We could do it 3D and live.
3D theater, though, but theater is already in 3D. So the thing we have to do is make it 2D. Somehow make theater in two dimensions.
Ooh, I know how we could do that. We could take a theatrical performance, record it with a video camera, and then project it in theater.
That is revolutionary. I think this is it. I think this is what we do. That sounds great. That sounds great. I have done serious plays before. I mean, you know, when I was young and I actually thought Hurley Burley was a good play, I did that. I did that right after I graduated college.
Where did you do that?
I did that at the ART in Cambridge, which is the theater that's associated with Harvard.
Yeah, that's a real theater.
Yeah, we were in the black box. We weren't on the proscenium stage.
But still, that is a stunning theatrical credit.
It is. It was, and it was a wonderful. I did a couple shows there that summer. I did a Durang one act night. Yeah, it was great. I really liked working there. And you know, Harvard kids are nice. They're nice kids. I enjoyed them.
That's good to hear, especially, you know, I see here that you went to NYU, so they didn't spit on you or look down at you?
No, because another buddy of mine from NYU, we were, you know, doing these shows with them, and I think, you know, they thought we were kind of interesting. You know, the way scientists think, you know, a rat with a tumor is interesting.
Well, you must know I also went to NYU, and I think now that I realize that you were only a few years ahead of me, so it's possible we know some of the same people, which is really fascinating.
When did you graduate?
I'm class of 1996 from the Tisch School of the Arts.
Oh, yeah. We probably had some mutual knowings.
Well, let's just jump ahead to that. So NYU, you went to which of the illustrious acting studios?
I went to Circle in the Square for 3 years. It was a three-year undergrad program. And then my senior year, I did I think – I can't remember what he called it. It was like clown school or comedy school with Damian Pop Christoph, which was a very fun way to go, because when you're studying the method for 3 years, and that's his method is the complete opposite. The method is creating an inner life and then building your character from inside. But Eastern European theater is fun because you don't do that. You start on the outside and you let it in get inside of you. And that that was so refreshing to go from the inner, you know, almost too self-indulgent, you know, method stuff to just let's be goofs, and then you find an emotional life out of creating a character from the outside in.
So most of your career has been more inspired by Pop Christoph than how about the work that you did with Tony nominee Lori Peters at the Circle in the Square?
Yes, I loved working with Lori in the Meisner technique. She was a very good Meisner teacher. I think a lot of Meisner, not necessarily at NYU, but just in general. I know a lot. I've overheard Meisner, you know, in quotes, Meisner classes in LA where it's just people yelling at each other incessantly. And it's like, well, I think you guys are kind of missing the point, but that's all right. But yeah, it was great. I mean, I'm not, you know, poo-pooing the method at all. It is very, a very helpful technique, but I like to be able to pull from all the different kinds of techniques, because the method doesn't always work for the tone of a piece or whatever. Yep.
And NYU is, of course, a really valuable theatrical experience. You and I went there. It was, of course, expensive, but now it's gotten much more expensive. And I imagine by the time your son wants to go, it'll probably redouble, maybe 70, 80,000 a year tuition will be then. So I think my question is, how much debt are you willing to take on for your son to have his own theatrical dreams revealed at NYU in the future?
Well, I'm sort of debating that right now, having a lot of conversations with the wife, because I do want to push my son into show business so I can live vicariously through him, because my career is didn't work out quite exactly how what I'd hoped. But if I can get his and turn him into the kind of formidable actor that I wanted to be, and live through him vicariously, that'd be great. But at the same time, you're right. It's very, very expensive and it's risky. So the other thing on the table is once he turns 16, send him to trade school.
Right.
Maybe carpentry. Maybe that's the best thing, because Harrison Ford was a carpenter. So if he learns a trade and becomes a carpenter and we stay here in LA and he starts building houses, maybe he'll get cast, in whatever the next Star Wars picture is. That's not actually.
Get discovered, right?
I think carpentry is the best way, or maybe plumbing. I don't know. Plumbing, electrical work, but carpentry. You get out there and you're banging nails, and you're out in the sun, and you're sweaty, and the housewives are checking you out, and then the producers notice that. So maybe carpentry is the best thing.
So is your son already manly, or is he on the goofy side?
He's gonna be way more manly than me. He's got a great sense of humor, but he's not. He's not. I'd like to think that he's not gonna be as much of a buffoon as I am. I'm hoping. We'll see. Who knows?
Which book of acting, besides your own, contains the most truth?
Book of acting? Do you mean a book about the business of acting, as my book is about, or do you mean more a book about the craft of acting?
I care much more about the craft than I do about employment.
good for you. Good for you. That actually is that is the way to go into the entertainment industry, is to care more about the craft than actually being employed, because chances are you're not going to be employed that much. For me, it's like technique-wise, I really actually liked Michael Caine's book, not his autobiography, but his book. I think it was just called Michael Caine on Acting. And sort of the simple way he approaches everything made the most sense to me. And I read, all the stuff in college, the Uta Hagen and the stuff by the group theater people and Stanislavski and all that. And there's all good stuff, but Michael Caine's was so simple and easy to understand and made practical sense for today, modern times, I think. So that's why that one resonated for me.
Like the Bible, do you reread these books on a daily or weekly basis?
I'm funny about books. I read books one time, and I very rarely reread books. I think the only book I've read more than once is Stephen King's The Stand, but that's when I was a kid. I haven't read it since then.
Yeah, funny, because in terms of your book, I read like the first three pages and the last three pages.
So you got through six pages of it? Good, good. Those are some solid pages, actually. The first three and the last three. Those are the highlights.
Well, as a theater professor, there are some very dangerous themes in there.
Yeah, that's not.
If I look at one of your earlier transcripts from a different interview you gave, it seems to me that you are advocating, in this quote that I can't read right now, it's not in front of me, but I read something about you in my research while we were chatting during this conversation, that you said that, people can save cash if they don't study theater. Do you understand how that's on my profession as a theater professor, and I just wanted to rake you over the coals and make sure you know that you're doing damage.
I know. I'm hurting the economy in a lot of ways. You're right. My book is not to be taken completely seriously. I don't know if I said it's been a while since I've looked at my own book, but I do feel like all that I learned at NYU was very valuable for me as a craftsman. Okay, understanding my craft, but the hard truth about the business is that you do not need to understand your craft to make money. You don't need to be a good actor to make money. It's all about your own personal, you know, pride as someone who practices, you know, an art form. So
where did your pride go?
My pride?
Where did it go?
It went. I traded it for money. I traded it, and not a lot. Small amounts of money. I like to say that, I haven't completely sold off my soul. I didn't just do a like major soul trade with the devil. I like chip off little bits and get a little bit back. So that's sort of where, you know, my pride has gone, is into making a little bit of money. Yeah.
Well, speaking of pride, I read that you have recently worked for TV Land.
I did. I did work on a show that's on TV Land. Yeah, that's true.
How did that project come to be?
I was at home. This was August, and my wife, who is a elementary school teacher, had started work. They go back to work for 2 weeks before the school year starts. So I was sort of stay-at-home dad for 2 weeks, dragging my son around to auditions when it was necessary, but finding play dates for him and all that stuff when I had enough notice. But this particular morning, my theatrical agent called and said, they want to see you on this for this one-day guest star on the show called The X's, but they want to see you in a half hour. So that gave me no time to take my son anywhere. And I said to him, well, I have my son with me. I would have to bring him to the audition. And he said, well, the trick to this audition is if you get the part, you're going to go right to set and shoot. Which is, doesn't happen. So the whole thing was sort of an emergency casting session, I guess. Cause they had a scene that wasn't working, and then they realized, oh, we can make this scene funny if we add another character into it. And a sort of innocent bystander character. So I, said, well, I would have to bring my son to work with me in order to, you know, I wouldn't have a choice. So if that's not cool, then I'm not going to go. I can't, you know, it's logistically impossible, but they ultimately decided, okay, we'll figure something out if you get the part. So I actually took my son and went through the whole audition process with me. And you know, it was like instant callbacks. It was one of those cruel situations. Usually, you know, you go and you leave and they don't call or they call. In this situation, you know, you're in a room filled with actors and everybody does their audition. And then the casting director comes down and basically says, well, this is really awkward. You're all really good. But you and you stay, everybody else can go. And then we had our callback, and then we're sitting down there, and then they came down and said, all right, thanks guys. You guys are great. Todd, you're going to set. And so my son and I went to set, and it was great because everybody on the show is very nice and understanding. And, you know, when I was rehearsing, there were actresses and crew people hanging out with my son. Yeah, that's how that whole thing came to be. It was actually kind of an awesome day. Awesome day of bit part acting.
That's amazing. Well, let's return to, of course, my favorite topics, which has to do with theater.
Right. Yeah. Well, yes, you're a professor of theaters.
What is the most important play ever written?
Oh, my. I think the most important play ever written, I would say, I'm going to say Carrie the Musical.
Why do you choose that?
Well, because I think that it really made it clear to future producers and investors that making a musical out of a Stephen King horror story and Brian De Palma film is a terrible, terrible idea. And I think they did that, so we know it, and great. I mean, that's some important stuff. It ultimately saved a lot of people a lot of money down the road. You know what I'm saying?
Yes, I actually have heard that it's quite a theatrical success, that people are enjoying it. I'm no fan of these adaptations of movies.
You're not? No? Oh, that's too... Because I was working on an adaptation of Snow Dogs for the theater. And I actually, I'm feeling pretty good that I might actually be able to get Cuba Gooding Jr. to reprise his role. For the stage production, and I think it'd be exciting to mount Snow Dogs.
My own bitter jealousy comes from the fact that my own teacher, William H. Macy, was nominated for the Oscar that year for his terrific work in Fargo.
It's a marvelous film.
You know, with all due respect to Cuba Gooding and that terrific movie about the sports agents.
The Jerry Maguire, yeah.
Jerry Maguire, yes. I really like that movie, but come on, William H. Macy. Sure.
I know, but this is the Academy. I mean, this year alone, you know, Meryl Streep, really? Iron Lady, really? I mean, Meryl Streep's a great actress, but that's not a great performance. It's okay, I guess, but there were movies that just are better movies than the movies that they put up there. Win-Win wasn't, you know, there, and there's lots of genre fare that wasn't there. I mean, to me, one of the best movies of the year was Attack the Block, which is, you know, a silly alien invasion movie, but it's a better realized picture than a lot of the movies that were nominated.
Well, like you, I'm a father, and so the best movie I saw in a theater last year was The Muppet Movie.
Ah, you were a fan of the Muppet movie.
Yes.
I thought that I liked it. I mean, I'm such a Muppet fan. I can pretty much enjoy any Muppet movie. And but as far as the theatrically released Muppet movies, I think this one was probably the weakest. And here's why. I thought it was, they separated in all the other Muppet movies. And you know, Treasure Island was probably this. The Muppet Treasure Island was probably the second, you know, worst one. But all of them, the Muppets and the people exist in a world together where nobody really acknowledges that there are Muppets and people. It's just they're in the same world. That's the world. And this movie really separated the Muppets and the people. It was, it was, I don't know, Muppetist, whatever the race is, you know what I mean? And you know, while it had a lot of great moments and a lot of fun stuff, I thought there was too much Jason Segel and not enough Muppets. And it started from a really sad place. I mean, why does it have to be getting the band back together? Why can't it just be another Muppet movie? We've never had a problem with that before. And then the other thing that bugged me about the Muppet movie is all the critics kept talking about how Muppets from Space was this terrible movie. And I disagree. I thought Muppets from Space was a lot of fun.
But I think that maybe Master Segel was really experimenting with a more dark approach to the Muppet story. And therefore, when he sang that song, Am I a Man or Am I a Muppet, it really meant something. And if it had been just a regular treatment of the Muppets, it wouldn't have had the type of deep catharsis and gestalt that we needed during that moment.
I mean, that certainly was a wonderful song and well deserving of the Oscar this year, I guess, even though there were only two songs nominated. You'd think there'd be more, but it's a great song. But if to build an entire movie around one bit, that seems, erroneous. Now, I wasn't 100% because Frank Oz refused to do. I found that a little distracting, actually, the voice work of Miss Piggy and like Fozzie the Bear. I mean, it wasn't bad. It just was a little distracting to me because it wasn't as good as the guy who does Kermit the Frog now sounds so much like Henson did. It's less distracting. But the replacement for Frank Oz was not quite the same. But Frank Oz refused to do it because he said it didn't capture the spirit of the Muppets. And when I heard him, I was like, well, you're being a jerk because you did Yoda in all the Star Wars prequels, which don't capture the spirit of the original Star Wars at all. But after seeing the movie, I kind of understand what he was saying. It didn't, you know, and again, I don't think it was a bad movie. I just don't think it was it kind of missed the point of the Muppets a little bit. I kind of agree with Frank Oz.
Todd Robert Anderson is a Muppet purist.
Well, no, because I've gotten in arguments with people because, you know, I love a Muppet Christmas Carol, and I really did like Muppets from Space, and those are, you know, post-Henson ones, and a lot of people have a problem with the post-Henson, you know, stuff. So I wouldn't say I'm a purist, but I guess that's why – and I did like the new Muppet movie. I did, but I just – it was a little bit dark, and it's weird that they separated the Muppets from the people. It felt racist to me.
Mm. I think it was one of the themes of the film, so I think it was their intention.
To be
a Muppetist, yeah. I think that was part of what they were trying to, you know, explore, what it means to be a Muppetist and to try to get... They were trying to tear down the walls, but in order to tear down the walls, they had to build the walls first.
You know what would have been awesome? Is if Kermit the Frog had baked Jason Segel a shit pie.
Wow, you see, now we're getting into a whole different genre. I mean, Jason Segel and the Apatow type of aesthetic. I wanted to ask you about that because this year Jonah Hill got an Oscar nomination, you know, Superbad, and the American Pie type aesthetic is huge in Hollywood. So I guess maybe that's a really good way to ask the question is, when are you going to be able to join this party and play more inappropriate characters in film and television?
That's a solid question that I do not have the answer to. These things are completely dependent on dumb luck. And if I get lucky, I will happily join the Apatow hijinks. But until then, you know, I'll just keep going on the auditions that they will have me on.
I guess maybe a different way to ask the question is, how have you let Jonah Hill's acting technique and Michael Cera's acting technique influence the way that you approach the craft today?
Well, like Jonah Hill, my weight tends to fluctuate. So I will drink too much and eat too much crappy food and then get heavy, and then I'll diet and work out. And then I'll get sick of that, and then I'll drink too much and eat too much again. And I go back and forth just like Jonah Hill. So that's how that's what I'm doing in the Jonah Hill arena. As far as Michael Cera is concerned, what I like to do is, if there was any project that, I did in the past that essentially made my career, I become very difficult about, helping those people mount, any, similar projects. I like to get in the way of,
is that what he does?
You don't know about the whole Arrested Development movie. And I mean, he's doing it now, but he was, part of the reason it took so long is he was, not getting on board. He was the one guy who wasn't on board. Yeah.
Of all those celebrities, including Wayne State alumnus Jeffrey Tambor, of all that distinguished cast, he was the one who was holding things up?
Yeah, apparently. And I don't know. I can't remember what. There was some kind of. They had gave some kind of business reason for it. But, you know. I mean.
Did you know that Juno was so. Last decade?
Yeah. But, you know, so was Arrested Development, really. So, you know. But, yeah, I didn't see the last movie. What was it, Scott Pilgrim versus the World? I didn't see that. I hear it's all right, though.
Yeah, That is a trip, and I've heard from secondary and tertiary sources that that movie is best enjoyed if you have a medical license, a medical, what do you call those things in California?
A medical
marijuana, yes.
Card, your card, yeah.
That's what I have been told from a variety of sources, that that movie is best appreciated if you are a patient.
Yeah, there's a lot of movies out there that are better if you're a patient, I would imagine. But subtitled movies are tough if you're a patient.
It's way too much work.
It's too hard. It's too hard to watch and read. It is. Exactly. Fun fact about medical marijuana cards is they're completely useless. Really, the only thing, because you go to these the pharmacy, the doctors, you know, and they try to sell you these cards for an additional $20. But if you get pulled over, that a cop is not, it doesn't help you. You just need the prescription and your driver's license.
Oh,
so, yeah. So if you're ever getting one of those cards, skip it. It's a waste of money.
Well, California may be in billions of dollars of debt, but at least you have some things right when it comes to certain laws to do with those sorts of things.
Well, you know, who knows? Who knows? They're always going back and forth on this whole issue. They're always trying to make new rules, and people are trying to stop it, and the federal government's constantly threatening to step in. So I don't know. It seems like a good idea to legalize it completely. To me, but they sure make it difficult. But yeah, California's getting that right. But I mean, we are in so much debt that really we have to be high all the time just to deal with the pressure of the looming bills and everything else. Yeah.
Well, especially because you don't have the culture of New York or even of Detroit.
I've only been to Detroit once to shoot a commercial. And I stayed in a hotel and there was nothing around but, chain restaurants. So I didn't see the culture part of, Detroit. I mean, I didn't go out exploring Detroit.
Well, the next time you're shooting, I will show you much devastation, but I can also show you pockets of hope and of culture. We have some world-class museums and some of these destroyed buildings and houses that have been decimated by fires and by neglect have been painted and repurposed as pieces of art.
Wow. Well, that's cool. That's cool. And plus, doesn't like Clint Eastwood do all his movies in Detroit now?
Yes, allegedly, although I'm ashamed to admit that the most recent Super Bowl commercial was not actually shot in Detroit.
Oh, they cheated. They cheated. Did. Oh, that's because that was such a interesting commercial.
Yes, he sounded like him, but he didn't quite look right, did he?
Well, it was just a sort of an odd choice to have him, so pissed, I guess. I mean, I know that's what he does, and I love his movies and his pissed offness, but I thought that ad was odd. It's very odd.
Well, every Super Bowl without Todd Robert Anderson commercial is a wasted Super Bowl, in my opinion.
I agree wholeheartedly. I agree.
I seem to recall there was one where you were locked in a bathroom many years ago. Is that correct?
Yeah, that was a long time ago. Yeah, it was a Visa check card commercial, and I was locked in the bathroom, and then I wound up putting my wife's mask, skin mask on with green skin. Yeah, that actually stuff, whatever it was, my skin had a hue of greenness for days afterwards.
Well, speaking of, you know, making sure that you have safe and sanitary work environments and that all makeup will be carefully removed, I wanted to have you weigh in on the very important question and dilemma of the day, which is how are you going to vote, if you're willing to say publicly, for the SAG-AFTRA merger?
Oh, yeah, I have no problem talking about how I vote. I'm going to vote for the merger. Because it is at this point, I think, the only thing that makes any sense. And I think a big reason for that is AFTRA has been undercutting SAG ever since the writer's strike of a few years back. And you know, it's just SAG's there isn't as much SAG work out there anymore because AFTRA is cheaper. So this way, you know, maybe more shows will go SAG again and it'll be, we'll make more money maybe. But also it just doesn't, the other problem that I, you know, I'm not a huge fan of any of the actors unions, because there's the fact that there's so many, there should just be one actors union. I don't understand having a separate stage union and a separate, you know, screen actor and then radio actor. It's all, we're all actors, you know. It's like in LA too, there's like a thing about, you know, you're a commercial actor or you're a theatrical actor. You're an actor and you're trying to get work, and it doesn't matter if it's on the radio or on a stage or on a movie screen or on the TV. What you want is someone to give you money to act. And the fact that there's so many unions, all it does is diffuse the power of the actor as far as, you know, contract negotiations are concerned. I mean, SAG already has, I mean, when they were talking about merger, when it first started, they had a vote on merger, and I voted against it because I was like, there are already too many people in the Screen Actors Guild, we don't need to add more people to it. But at this point, I'm sort of like, let's just merge all Equity and AFTRA, just put them all together and stop letting people into the union willy-nilly. Because there's too many people in the union who are not actors at all, and they just think it's fun to have a SAG card. Dennis in the Midwest who, you know, got roped into a movie and it was a union movie, so they had to Taft Hartley. I mean, that's ridiculous. Ridiculous.
Is most reality TV AFTRA, or is reality TV...
Most reality TV is non-union. Non-union. Yep.
Of course, they're stealing our jobs.
They are. The thing that bothers me the most about reality TV is the acting is so bad. I mean, and it's not, you know, it's, they get away with it by calling it reality TV, and these are real people, and that's why they suck. You know, their interviews are stilted. They're, when they get the producers, you know, manufacture, it's basically bad improvisation is what they're doing. It's terrible, terrible improvisation. And I don't get why people like that, but they do. The only reality show I ever watched, you know, more than once was Steven Seagal, Lawman.
Nice.
And that's because Steven Seagal is just so fascinating to me. And that show was hilarious because it was just cops, but with Steven Seagal. And when these people, like cracked out people, get arrested and they're angry, but then they realize one of the cops is arresting them is Steven Seagal, it completely disarms the whole situation. And it's actually a really good idea if they got like more famous actors to do this kind of deputy work with cops. It would diffuse so much violence, you know, in these you know, situations where cops have to arrest people who are wasted because they immediately go, oh, I mean, imagine that if you were, you know, a terrible criminal and you were getting arrested and you're screaming against the man, but then, aren't you Chuck Norris? You know, it would be like, oh my gosh, this is awesome. I'm getting arrested by Chuck Norris. Oh, I think it's a good idea.
Can Don Johnson still run, do you think?
I don't know. I would think Don Johnson can still, you know, move. I mean, he certainly could move as fast as Steven Seagal. Steven Seagal is hauling around a lot of weight these days. But I don't know if he can run as fast as Don Johnson can run as fast as he did, you know, like in the movie Dead Bang at the beginning. Did you ever see that picture?
No.
It's greatest. one of the greatest foot chases. It's the beginning of the movie. Don Johnson is playing, you know, an alcoholic cop, because all cops in movies are burned out alcoholic cops. And then he gets into a chase, has to chase this perpetrator, and it's a really long foot chase, and he finally, you know, catches the guy and tackles him and cuffs him and then just barfs all over his back because he's hungover. It's such a good chase scene. And that is the only time, you know, that's a very realistic thing. If you're horribly hungover and you get into a high-speed foot chase that goes on for blocks and blocks, chances are you're going to barf at some point.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's intense.
Yeah, it is. It is. It's intense stuff.
I have to add that to my Netflix queue. Right now I'm way too busy investigating the Michael Chekhov technique. And I've also been reading a lot of Martin McDonagh lately.
So you don't have time to squeeze in Dead Bang with Don Johnson?
I'll have to write it down now and make sure that I can find time. Because, you know, it is my job to stay hip, to know where the industry is moving. And the last time I was in Los Angeles, I got this sense of panic from the actors because of the proliferation of the SLR cameras, and that anybody can make a movie now.
Mm.
My curiosity is, in your time in Los Angeles, how is the industry changing, and where do you see it going, and what advice would you give to a young actor moving to LA?
Well,
besides telling them to buy your book.
Yeah, buy my book. No. Okay, so first part of the question is, how has it changed since I got here?
Where's the industry going? How's it moving?
Well, I mean, obviously, it's really in a place of, I would say, growing pains right now, because there is such – the market is so – has dispersed so much into all these different places. I mean, you've got – it's true that anyone can make a movie at this point. It's not true that anyone can make a good movie, but it's definitely true that anybody can pick up a camera and create some kind of movie. And I would say that because of that, and 1.5 million cable channels, and that's why, you know, the studios with movies now are, you know, everything's got to be in 3D, because it separates the movies and makes the movies special again, even though I'm not a fan. I get the need for that kind of marketing to make going to the movies an event again. But, you know, I think it's all these different factions, the TV people, and, you know, and it's true actually in theater too. I mean, that's why there are so many revivals and taking movies and turning them to Disney movies and turning them into musicals, because they're trying to it's so hard to create a new brand at this point, because everything is so all over the place, that's why they keep going back to the same brands and remaking the same things. But you know, eventually it'll settle down one way or the other. I mean, most likely, you know, eventually we're going to experience another kind of renaissance like we had in the 70s, because all these people who have all the money are going to stop making money and realize, well, how do we make money? And they'll wind up putting smaller amounts of money in the hands of actual artists. And then we might, you know, have a renaissance in cinema. And I would say the best stuff really right now is on television. I mean, the best gigs to get as an actor, the most challenging gigs to get as an actor really are, on TV. Cause on TV you have stuff like Breaking Bad and Mad Men and you know, even Sons of Anarchy and these things that are actually different and feel different. The movies, it's all, you know, it's either John Carter or it's a pretentious art film. There isn't a lot of, you know, stuff in the middle. It's like bombastic or, you know, incredibly artsy fartsy, as opposed to, I mean, and there's always exceptions. I mean, I'm making general statements here. Like, you know, I mentioned Win-Win before, and I thought that was a great movie. Without...
Are you venturing into the no money fun films? Are you going to make your magnum opus? Are you going to make a movie yourself and direct a terrific theatrical?
I don't. You know, it's I'm funny. I mean, the only time I do shorts for the internet, and when I've done Thea, I did a one man show, and I had my late night comedy show, The Film Pigs, on in theater. Like all the stuff that I've done and then I've mounted was simply because if I didn't, it wouldn't have existed. And it was making work for myself. But I'm not, I don't have these giant aspirations of being a filmmaker. I have done things because simply because nobody else would do it. Like the chicken in that old fable who makes bread and asks everybody to help. And they're like, no, I'm not going to help you with the bread, and the chicken makes the bread on her own and then everybody wants to eat it sort of thing. Even though they didn't help. I don't know if that's a very good analogy, but I co-produced a shoestring feature, but really, I played the lead, and it was my friend's, shoestring feature. He's not even done with it. We shot it 4 years ago, and he's still, working on it because it takes a long time to do post-production when you have no money. That's the closest I've got. But really, it was him doing most of the work. I was just doing the acting. And for me, that's I like acting, and I like to focus on the acting itself. I don't think I could do, I don't like wearing a bunch of hats because I'm just not that good at it. I'm the kind of guy who, if I'm directing a play and I'm in the play, I wind up like I'll get lost within, like screw up my own performance looking at other people's performance suddenly. I'm not coordinated on that level. I like to do one thing at a time.
Well, returning to the craft of acting, when you magically repaired the car in that insurance commercial, how did you visualize, because I'm sure that was computer generated, how did you visualize the before and after while you were washing that car?
It was not entirely computer generated. So they used CGI to clean it up and make it look better, but they had a special effects car. They used practical effects, and actually the car was made out of some kind of rubbery material that still had a shine to it, so it looked like a real car door. But there were guys inside the car with basically metal poles stuck to the inside of the car, and they'd make the dents by pulling the poles, and then they push the dents out from inside the car. So I actually had to do no acting work whatsoever as far as visualizing something, because it was happening in front of me.
Having to do no acting work whatsoever seems to be a bit of a recurring theme.
Well, yeah. Yeah, it is kind of a recurring theme. I mean, I'm also lazy by nature, and I do as little as I can do is great. I mean, I love a challenge, sure, but the shoestring budget movie that I did with my friend, where I was the lead, was very challenging. But it was, a lot of it was just because I was working all the time. It was exhausting. But when all you do is spray a hose on a car, and they wanted me to do as little as possible, I mean, that was my direction, you're just washing a car. You're not frustrated with it. You're not happy about it. You're just washing a car. We don't want you to do anything, because they don't want to distract from the product, and they don't want to distract from the concept of the commercial with some actor being crazy.
How argumentative did you become with that direction? Because I'm upset when I receive that sort of direction, because I'm a very serious artist, and I already have a very specific objective, emotional preparation. I have a variety of tactics in pursuit of my objective, and to be told to do less is an insult to my craft.
I sometimes do get aggravated, and there are certain directions that make no sense. The other day, I was talking to my actor friend Jesse. We'd both gone on the same audition, and the audition was basically screaming in terror. But the director said, "So, yeah, I want you to scream in terror, but make it casual."
How do you do that?
Exactly. Exactly. Those are the directions I have. You know, being told not to do anything. The trick is with going, because, you know, I studied theater and did theater for so long with the intention of, you know, being a movie actor. And, you know, the adjustment is very difficult. And I think going both ways, I mean, if you're not doing both, and even then, in theater, you have to give a bigger performance, not a muggy performance. You know, that doesn't mean mugging, and you know, it doesn't mean a bad performance, but it's bigger. You have to fill the space. You have to, the people at the back of the room have to hear you. And on camera, they're capturing you, and it's, the performance has to be very small. And it's not that you're not doing, so I think what happens a lot is, you know, especially in commercials, is people are coming from the theater, so they're, and they ask you to improv a lot, so people naturally kind of gravitate towards, you know, doing funny improvs versus, you know, not. And so one of the things that they say to people is, you're doing too much. Do less. Make it smaller. Do nothing. And I think that comes out of, you know, the adjustment that people are not making for the medium that they're acting in, if that makes any sense.
That's very specific. That's a very specific craft adjustment. And so I appreciate you sharing that with our audience. Well, I think we have time for one more question. The TomCast audience is dying to know, because you are perfectly poised to answer this sort of question, given your extensive research in the theater. My question is this. Did Shakespeare write all of his plays?
I don't have all the information there. I know Roland Emmerich thinks that he didn't. I think he probably did, but there's a high possibility that he didn't. He wrote a lot, but you know, honestly, they all sound like they're coming from a similar voice to me. So it's not like one of them sounds like Mamet and then the other one sounds, you know, like Roland Emmerich. They all sound pretty consistent. So I don't know if I buy into that theory, but, you know, it makes sense because he was prolific. So maybe he had a lot of ghostwriters who just knew how to write him. I don't know. I really don't know.
We will never know.
We won't, because, well, we will, because someone will eventually invent a time machine and go back in time and learn these things and then accidentally create parallel universes, and then we'll be turned inside out.
That would just mess up everything.
Yeah, that's why we need time cops. We need to start training time cops now in the event of a renegade time machine inventor.
Yes, yes. Well, speaking of the future and time, when you and your son are ready to embark upon your triumphant production of Death of a Salesman, I am a director for hire. I'd be happy to come out for no money.
We would love to work with you. And I'd also like to talk to you about maybe mounting a musical version of Time Cop for the stage.
Winning! That is a winning idea, because in the end, no matter how serious I am, what I really want to do is make a buck in the theater, and that is my plan.
That you know what? You can have it. Go for it. Make Time Cop the musical.
We'll find a part for you, maybe as a guy in the elevator.
That'd be great. I'm good in elevators. People always believe that I'm on the elevator when I'm acting on an elevator.
Well, Tom Robert Anderson, thank you so much for joining us on today's TomCast. Next week on the show, we have another alumnus of NYU and Circle in the Square, Idina Menzel. Until then, enjoy.